Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. A Million Little Pieces. That was the title of James Frey's memoir, and now, well, it just might be his journalistic reputation as well. A Million Little Pieces over the issue of truth and the controversy over his memoir that has largely now been debunked as nonfiction is reaching through the culture, asking some basic questions, raising very basic questions about whether we really value truth anymore and whether truth is even important anymore. Oprah Winfrey has played a part in this controversy, and so has the author and the publisher and just about everyone who's made a comment on this. And today is your opportunity to comment on this. Is it important anymore to tell the truth? Do we prefer fiction to nonfiction, and do we want our nonfiction really to end up being fiction? Do we really care whether a story is true anymore? Or now do we have this category of emotional truth that just means that what's important is what you want to be true or what you need to be true in order to tell the story the way you want the story told? The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. First, a review of issues in the news. The electoral victory of the Hamas party in the Palestinian Authority and in the Palestinian Parliament has raised all sorts of issues across the world. And even today, there is, in the aftermath of all of this controversy, still the opportunity to be surprised. And I was surprised when former President Jimmy Carter made this statement to Larry King.
Well, obviously, if you sponsor an election or promote democracy and freedom around the world, then when people make their own decision about their leaders, I think that all the governments should recognize that administration and let them form the government as decided by the people themselves. If there are prohibitions, for instance, like in the United States, against giving any money to a government that is controlled by Hamas, then the United States could channel the same amount of money to the Palestinian people through the United Nations, through the Refugee Fund, through UNICEF, and things of that kind.
Now, what makes that statement, I think... altogether bizarre, is the lack of moral urgency about the nature of Hamas. Now, if you just take what he said at face value, if he had said that after prefacing with very clear denunciations of Hamas and its policy of the destruction of Israel and its associations with terrorism, then that might make some sense. But, you know, the election of Hamas is not like the election of some third party in the United States or some green party in Europe. You're talking about a party that is part and parcel connected to terrorism and a party that has as its central purpose the destruction of Israel. And lest you wonder about that, just look at the statements made by Hamas leadership after the election, not before the election, not in years past, after the election, when they talk about such things as pushing the Israelis into the sea. And when you have this hatred and commitment to terrorism and all of this now ensconces the government, the big question I would have to have is, how do you recognize that government? And again, I think it comes back to the big question of democracy, and that is democracy effective as a form of government in always achieving the best outcome? And you'd have to say, I think, looking at history, that the answer to that is not always yes. Now, before you all of a sudden say, well, good grief, you don't believe in democracy. Oh, I do. But I believe in democracy the way I think a Christian should believe in democracy. And that is that, as Winston Churchill said, it's the worst form of government ever tried, except for all the others. In other words, we know that human beings are sinners, and we know that human depravity will work its way out in society and in the culture. We know that if you concentrate power in an autocrat, in a dictator, in a king, in an aristocracy, then you just concentrate that power and evil in such a way that sin is all the more to be expected to come out of that process in terms of bad policies and oppression and injustice and all the rest. Democracy doesn't make people good. Democracy simply is the best means of preventing the concentration of human sinfulness in an autocrat or in a dictator or in a king, a monarch, a queen, a prince, or whatever. But you can't always assume that democracy is going to come out with the right kind of vote. I mean, after all, I think if we're honest, there's certain things we don't want to put to a vote right now here in America. And certainly, when you look at the world history, just go back to the 20th century, go back to the 1930s, when the National Socialist Party in Germany, the Nazis, headed by Adolf Hitler, when that government, that party is elected to power. You know, Adolf Hitler did not gain power by a coup d'etat. He was elected. And after he'd formed the government, yes, he did eventually get rid of the chancellor, but the reality is that he was elected. But that didn't make him right. When we talk about Hamas and we're looking at these unfolding trouble spots and even powder kegs there in the Middle East, we have to realize that it is right to encourage democracy. But just one democratic election does not a responsible democratic republic make. There's good news, at least potential good news, coming out of the United Nations, and when that happens, as rare as it may be, we ought to take note of it. And that good news is that it appears that the Security Council is soon to consider the issue of Iran and its nuclear ambitions. And it's high time. I mean, what do they have to do for the Security Council to take seriously the fact that they have defied their ordinances, they have defied their orders, they have defied international opinion, they have defied international agreements, and are absolutely determined? And when you look at Iranian President Ahmadinejad, and you start looking at his incredible statements, including, much like Hamas, the destruction of Israel, the delegitimization of Israel, the destruction of Israel, you have to realize we've got not just one, but several powder kegs in the Middle East, as if that's something completely new. Talk about a sign of the times. Oxford University is now going to require its students to sign a contract agreeing to go to class and to do their homework. Now, you know there has to be a story behind that, and the story is this. There are universities that are now being sued by graduates or by those who failed to graduate because they say they did not receive the education they came for. Oxford's right up front about this. And again, we're not talking about some little college or some little institution on the in an office park on the periphery of some suburban town here. We're talking about Oxford University, one of the oldest and greatest universities in the entire world. And it is now reduced to requiring its students to sign a contract agreeing that they will attend classes and do the work assigned and read the books and attend the lectures. Because otherwise, the university says, you guys are suing us for not giving you an education when the reality is you didn't even go to class. I find this one of the most remarkable pieces of news I've seen in a long time. Now, admittedly, I have to read this as a college president and a seminary president looking at this because I have to wonder, how long is it before we all have to have contracts signed by students in which they agree to go to class? But it is just one little glimpse into the circus of much modern higher education, where, amazingly enough, a lot of students don't go to class. In some institutions, they'll tell you they don't have to go to class, even to do well. They can just read the books, or they can talk to their friends, or lately, they can even get pirated lectures by podcast from their friends. Who needs to go to class anymore? What an outdated notion. Does Christianity squash women? That's the title of a new book by Rebecca Jones, and my favorite book reviewer has given a good review of this book, and that is my wife, Mary. It's published at Reformation 21. And I was particularly struck by this paragraph that Mary wrote in the review of this book. She said, yes, the gender issue matters. Yes, it goes beyond being a peripheral issue because it is anchored to the primary issue of biblical authority. How heartening it is that as evangelicals, we can join ranks in this pivotal debate and let the chips fall where they may. The more our families are seen as happy and holy places where submission and sacrificial love actually work, the more our churches reflect the amazing phenomenon of men and women joyfully working together based on God's design, the more the world will wonder. However, we realize that the beautiful picture of Christ and his church in our homes and our churches will draw men and women to himself. Well, as I said in my weblog today, that was well said and well worth saying, and I have a new favorite literary critic. You can find my article, and you can find a link to her review at Albert Mohler, that's MOHLER.com. And I also want to add my word of commendation for Rebecca Jones' book, Does Christianity Squash Women? You know, the bottom line of all of this is that the postmodern culture especially as found in many universities and the media elite, just assumes that Christianity is inherently intolerant of women, oppressive of women, oppressively patriarchal, and treats women as second-class citizens. And Rebecca Jones is one of those who knows better and comes back as a woman to say difference does not mean lesser. God's pattern of complementarity between the genders, between the sexes, is a reflection of His own glory and His design for our good. Now that is a countercultural message. I have to love a book with a title, Does Christianity Squash Women? ? And I have to love an author who will come back and say, no, and here's why, and here's how to reset the question. Turn the thing on its head. Well, that's what we need to do when it comes to the question of truthfulness in a memoir. You know, we're now being told that's just too much to expect when someone who says he's telling the truth would actually be telling the truth. I want to know what you think about this. You've been hearing the controversy. The phone number, 877-893-8255. I'm Albert Mohler. The book is entitled A Million Little Pieces, and the controversy has gone in about a million different directions. The controversy is over James Frey's memoir, and I guess we still use the word memoir, even though both camps, that is, his accusers and his publisher, now admit that if it's a memoir, it's largely a fictive or fictional memoir. The controversy came up because James Frey's book, A Million Little Pieces, was chosen for America's Book Club. No, I misspeak. It's Oprah's Book Club. She just thinks it's America's Book Club. And she is now creating massive bestsellers. And of course, there have already been controversies about this. I find it absolutely fascinating that you have the Jonathan Franzen controversy over his book, The Corrections. Then you have this. You have A Million Little Pieces by James Frey. And it's got the sticker. I got in the copy I have right here in the studio. It's got the sticker with a giant O on the front. Oprah's Book Club, which means buy this book because Oprah says so. And Oprah Winfrey has jumped into this controversy. Why? Because a website known as SmokingGun.com really did an investigative report on this memoir and has proved beyond the shadow of any doubt that it's filled with lies. And I mean big ones. I mean ones that your mom and dad used to call whoppers. I mean ones like things that never even happened. I mean, you're not talking about taking a chronology and shifting it around. You're not talking about putting words and paraphrases into someone's mouth. You're talking about making stuff up in whole cloth. And the reality is that the book is about a man's story of being an alcoholic and a drug addict. And it's about his rehabilitation, twists and turns, his confrontations with the law, his really, really awful story from the inside about coping with all of this. And as Oprah said on her program, what makes this story so powerful is that a lot of people have read it, and it has, at least by her argument, given a lot of people hope. Well, what if the story just isn't so? SmokingGun.com went and looked at the particulars, and it just came up empty all over the place. For instance, he talks about being arrested. Well, it turns out he wasn't. He talks about being in jail. Turns out he wasn't. Talks about being blamed for the death of a girl in his adolescence. Turned out he wasn't. And you start looking at all these things, and it just doesn't add up. And by the time the reviewers have now finished with this, as the media swarm has looked at this memoir, the question isn't really anymore how much of it is false, but how much of it is even true. And he's got a new book out, and of course it gets headed towards the bestseller list because in our current contemporary culture, notoriety is about as good as anything else in terms of selling books. So his new book is entitled My Friend Leonard, and on the front of this one it says author of the New York Times bestseller, A Million Little Pieces, and My Friend Leonard is supposed to be the second volume of this, and there's every reason to believe that it's just as fictive as is A Million Little Pieces. Now, I want to tell you why we're talking about this today. It's really not about the memoir itself, because my guess is that's not the raging issue here, and long term that's not going to be what we're talking about. We're going to talk about why America sometimes would rather have the untrue packaged as the true than to face the truth itself. And I want to just say something very clearly here. I think Oprah Winfrey bears a lot of responsibility for being society's enabler of confusing this whole idea of truth. And it's, again, what happens when you exchange truth for therapy. We have, in our modern therapeutic culture, the idea that you have your truth, and whatever truth helps you to cope and to be authentic and to get over your problems and to be happy with yourself is the truth. It's the truth for you. And folks, you encounter this when you're in conversation with people and you talk about all these therapeutic, the whatever step methods, and you start listening to this literature and you start listening to the people talking that are so infected with this therapeutic worldview, and they'll talk about, this is my truth. Well, hold on, folks. If it's true, it's true. 2 + 2 = 4, okay? That's just a truth. And if that truth comforts you or afflicts you, it doesn't matter. It's still true. Gravity is a force that pulls objects to Earth. That's true. Whether you like it or not, whether it affirms you or not, whether it helps you to get over your addiction or not, it's still true. You jump out of the building, you're going down, not up. That's the story. It's just true. There are certain truths that can't be overlooked. And you can't lie and tell the truth at the same time about the same facts. Now, Oprah Winfrey, I said, bears a lot of responsibility for this because she chose this book. And here's the deal now. We know that she chose this book after SmokingGun.com had already, rather famously, debunked it. And yet she continued, even in the aftermath of this, to support it, as did James Fry. James Fry went on Larry King Live not once but twice. Oprah called in, very famously, in the program, the Larry King program, in order to defend the program. And to defend the book, that is. But, you know, it comes right down to the big question. Is it actually true or not? And do we care? Emotional truth. Now, how's that for a new definition of truth? Emotional truth is the truth that you want to be true because you like it better than what's actually true. And once you have this emotional truth, it's beyond anyone's assault in terms of whether it's factual or not. In the aftermath of the controversy over James Frey's book, Oprah Winfrey said, hey, its story of redemption still comes through. It still comes through powerfully. Let's listen to Oprah Winfrey explain her reaction to this. Folks, run clip number one.
I read this book as a memoir, and to me a memoir means it's the truth of your life as you know it to be, and not blatant fictionalization. So when I pick up a book and it says it's a memoir, I'm thinking that that is your life. I'm not thinking that that's a character. I'm thinking that that is Lily and that that happened to you. And I sat on the stage back in September and I asked you, you know, lots of questions. And what you conveyed to me, and I think to millions of other people, was that that was all true. That was all true.
I made a mistake.
Oh, well, that's slightly better than saying, as politicians are wont to say, mistakes were made. But he didn't make a mistake. He, well, here's the word for it, lied. But listen, you just heard Oprah Winfrey say that. That was on the 26th of January. But back on the 14th of January, she called in and had a very different message. And this is when she called into the program. Guys, this is clip 11.
And I feel about A Million Little Pieces that although some of the facts have been questioned, and people have a right to question because we live in a country that lets you do that, that the underlying message of redemption in James Fry's memoir still resonates with me, and I know that it resonates with millions of other people who have read this book and will continue to read this book.
Okay, now the key words there to really hear are where she says, the underlying message of redemption in James Frey's memoir still resonates with me, and I know it resonates with millions of other people who've read this book. Okay. There are great works of fiction of which that kind of language would be entirely appropriate. You can read The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. You can read The Sound and the Fury by William Faulkner. You could read The Night by Elie Wiesel. You can read many of these great works, and by the way, Night is semi-autobiographical, but nonetheless, you could read these works, and as you read them, yes, you could hear these themes coming through, and they could be powerfully resonating within you. But what if it isn't true? Do you want to resonate with that which isn't true? You see, that's the problem. James Frey presented this as the truth. It's a memoir. He didn't sell it as a novel. And it probably wouldn't have done as well as a novel, and he wouldn't have created this entire personality where he has his own website and his own fan club, and he's now considered an expert in having gone through these things. You know, this is like having an actress who plays a doctor come before Congress to testify on medical issues. That's happened. This is the world we're living in. Truth and fiction are becoming so confused that some people just throw up their hands in resignation and say it doesn't even matter. I want to know for you, does it matter to you? Do you care anymore about the truth? And are you offended when someone packages a lie as the truth? 877-893-8255. I'm Albert Mohler.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Truth and fiction. You know, there's a lot of argument about this in the business world. There's a lot of argument about this and controversy about this among politicians and now in the literary world as well. And, of course, you know, anyone who's a parent knows that one of the things you have to do is to help children understand the difference between what's real and what's not and what's true and what's false. And that's why you have to have the indispensable category of lying. Because you only know what the truth is when you know what a lie is, and you know how to tell the difference. And by the way, there are those who say, well, I'll be able to tell the difference, even with a literary memoir. Mary Carr, who is the author of The Liar's Club, how do you like that for a title? And the memoir Cherry says this, she says, and I quote from Time Magazine, this is not rocket science, this is not like sexing a chicken. Is it fiction? Is it nonfiction? I think the entire book is, well, horse excrement's what she says. And, you start looking at this and you realize that there are those who have staked their lives on what they've written, and they're very offended that James Fry has now mixed these categories to such an extent. We got calls coming in. I want to know, folks, does this offend you? Or is it even possible to be offended about this anymore? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Christians are to be the people of the truth. How important is it that we really demand truth, even in a story like this? Now, there are a couple of things I want us to hear again, and the staff here has done a great job pulling these clips together. There are a couple of statements made by James Fry that I think really just set all this out. Guys, let's roll 9 and 10. Just put them on.
What's your side, James?
My side is that I wrote a memoir. You know, I never expected the book to come under the type of scrutiny that it has. A memoir, the word literally means my story. A memoir is a subjective retelling of events.
But it's supposed to be factual events. A memoir is a form of biography.
Yeah, a memoir is within the genre of nonfiction. I don't think it's necessarily appropriate to say I've conned anyone.
I think I made a lot of mistakes in writing the book and promoting the book.
Do you see the mistakes as lies? Because you know, I think I made a mistake. I think I made a mistake by leaving the impression that the truth doesn't matter because that's not how I live. I think that's a mistake. I don't think I lied. So do you think you lied or you think I made a mistake?
I think probably both.
I think probably both, too. In fact, assuredly both. And, that is one of the words of moral evasion in our current culture. It's mistake. A mistake is when you set the thing down on the wrong table. And, a mistake is when you pick up the wrong, identification tag when you get to the party, the wrong name tag. It's not when you put the wrong name tag on intentionally and tell people you're the other person. That's the distinction. When you actually portray this as a truth that isn't true, it's not a mistake anymore. It's a lie. Let's go to Jenny calling from Hope, Arkansas, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Go ahead, Jenny.
Dr. Mohler, I just find it incredible that the majority of the American people seem to have lost the capability of independent thought. I don't understand why people read books because some supposed star says that they should. Why a person on television, whatever happened to truth in broadcasting, that someone can say that a memoir is supposed to be nonfiction, but then they lied and they made mistakes. The long and the short of it is either it's the truth or it isn't. Either he went to jail or he didn't. Either he caused someone's death or he didn't.
Okay, Jenny, I agree with you, and I want to ask you a question here very quickly. Is it at all appropriate, you think, for someone like Oprah to say that it's meaningful, even if it isn't true. All right, I may have lost you there, Jenny. The issue here is that the question is, can you say that something's meaningful that isn't true? I'm going to say yes, but not when someone claimed that it was true and you find out it's not true. Yeah, it's meaningful, all right. And the meaning of it is, this guy made up an incredibly powerful story. This guy should write fiction. You know, that's the reality. If he had written this as a novel, no one would be complaining. But it probably wouldn't be famous, and we probably wouldn't be talking about it, because what made the story so compelling to so many readers and what put it on the front page of a lot of newspapers and at the top of the New York Times bestseller list and on Oprah's show was that she went on and told people, not this guy's written a good story, but pointing to the author, she said, he has been through all of this. This is who he is. This is his story. When we come back, I want to talk about why we as Christians have to be particularly careful when giving our testimonies, because we have to make sure that we don't become James Fries in front of the church. This is the Albert Mueller Program. James Fry, when talking to Larry King just a few days ago, said, and I quote, "A memoir is a subjective retelling of events." Well, you know, there's a sense in which that, of course, is true, because you can only tell the story from your own vantage point. You can only talk about what you were feeling and what you were observing. You know, it's just like even telling a story. That's why in the court, when someone courtroom, when someone comes in as a witness, that's why they're cross-examined, and that's why they say, "Well, you were standing here. You saw the thing from this angle." That's entirely believable. That's natural, automatic. Uncontroversial. But when James Fry uses that to mean it's all right to make things up, then you're not really talking about just subjective, you're talking about dishonest. And lest we miss his point, Larry King comes back and says, "But it's supposed to be factual events. I mean, the memoir is a form of biography." James Fry said, "Yes, I mean a memoir is within the genre of nonfiction. I don't think it's necessarily appropriate to say I've conned anyone." And you know, what he's really saying here is people liked my story. They were encouraged by my story. They like my made-up story better than the real story. So, Larry, what's your problem? Listeners, what's your problem? Where do we as Christians have a particular responsibility here? I mentioned going into the break that I think we have a particular responsibility to always tell the absolute truth when we're telling our own testimony. Let's admit it, there have been scandals among Christians where it's been discovered that certain things didn't happen that were claimed to have happened. But, you know, at least we're the people that ought to know the difference between truth and fiction, and we ought to be the people who know that the truth is the only thing that will do. Let's go to Dawson, listening on WFIA in Louisville, Kentucky. What do you think, Dawson?
Yeah, Dr. Mueller, I believe that the sense of relativity that Fry is made by writing this book, that he can make up his own story to sell that. I think that's part of the postmodern era that's infiltrated the entire society that we live in here in America. And by doing that, it's telling just anyone that make your own story. That way people will like you and then later go back and tell them what's okay and what's not. And it's just postmodernism right at its root.
Well, Dawson, I agree with you, but why do we care? I mean, so what? So we live in a postmodern world. Let's just let everybody make up a story. What's the problem with that?
Well, I mean, if you get everybody making up their own stories, I mean, there's no sense of trust anywhere across the line. And who should we trust at that point? I think that's our job as Christians is we've always been mandated to be trustworthy. And when everybody is out and just making up whatever goes, I mean, what is truth? Truth's been diminished at that point, and, I mean, going right back to postmodernism, truth can be anything. It can be a series of religions, and there can be many saviors, just as a lot of religions believe, and that's just not how Christians do it. There's only one way.
Yeah, Dawson, you're just guilty, my friend, of being found in the very act of trying to think like a Christian, and I appreciate that. You're trying to think this through. Why do Christians have a particular allegiance to the truth, a special accountability to the truth? And it is because, after all, we follow in the way of the one who said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me." And Dawson raised the issue of the exclusivity of the gospel. I want to tell you why I think that's so keen a point here. It's because increasingly, authentic, orthodox Christian doctrine, clearly established in Scripture, is being rejected by people who say, I don't like that. I don't resonate with that. I don't feel good about that. It's this therapeutic mentality. It's this idea that we respond to truth at an emotional or affective level. You know, the exclusivity of the gospel, I don't like that. I don't feel any particular emotional attraction to the doctrine of the Trinity. And if you guys think I'm making this up, just come live in the world I have to go out in regularly. The world of modern theology, where you'll hear this kind of stuff all over the time. You hear the feminists say, the idea of God the Father just doesn't resonate with me. It's oppressive to me. That's not my truth. Well, you know what? What really matters is the truth. Now, I'm not denying for a moment that that we are all frail, finite human beings. Not any one of us has a complete grasp of all the truth. Only God himself does, the one who is the source of all truth. But that's why we're so dependent upon God's word. I mean, that is just part and parcel of why we are so dependent upon the revelation of God. And that's why the truth of God's word is so indispensable to the Christian life. Because otherwise, we are just left with whatever truth seems good to us, feels good to us. When the Apostle Paul was warning Timothy about this very danger, he spoke about the phenomenon of itching ears. And he said, people will pile up for themselves. I love Paul's hyperbole there. They'll pile up for themselves teachers who tell them what they want to hear. And good grief, isn't that what we see? And you go to the bookstore, people are piling up books that tell them what they want to know, what they want to believe, how they want to feel. I think this idea of emotional truth is really at the very core of where this society has lost its mind on the question of truth. James Fry said something else very interesting, by the way, and I'm going to have to paraphrase him here for sake of time, but he basically said, I couldn't have written this story, even the untrue parts, if I hadn't been through what truly happened to me. And by the way, he was a drug addict and he was an alcoholic. So he said, you know, no one but someone who had my experiences could have told these stories as if they were true. And he actually said at some point that he really was writing as someone who in his mind had experienced all these things. Well, you know, just imagine what you could do with that. You know, I anyone who's been a parent knows that your children can sometimes have imaginary friends. You know, that sometimes happens. And as a matter of fact, sometimes it comes up in very awkward ways when you find out that the kid's told his teacher that he's got a brother he doesn't have, but he imagined him. But you know what? If the parent starts going along with it, we got a big problem. If the parent starts buying Christmas gifts for the imaginary friend or the imaginary brother, we got a big problem. And if the parent starts turning him in as a dependent in his IRS tax forms, he's going to have a real problem with Uncle Sam. Because the people that count the shillings care about truth. And the people who enroll kids in the hospitals care about truth. And that's where we as Christians just have to come back again and again to say, look, we have to accommodate ourselves to truth rather than to think the truth can be accommodated to us. And if we are the people of the truth, then we have to value that which is true over that which is false. We have to put an absolute premium on seeking to get as much truth in and out of every book, every encounter, every conversation, every testimony, every sermon, because to do less is to fail in our responsibility to the one who is the truth. I think there's a lot to learn from this controversy. And as you see it unfold and there's a lot of conversation in the media, watch the secular world try to figure out just why it's supposed to be so concerned about truth in the first place. It's a fascinating thing to watch, and we as Christians have a particular perspective on this because we know why it matters not just now in terms of what's in the headlines, but why it matters for eternity. I'll be back in just a moment with some final thoughts. Coast to Coast, you're listening to the Albert Mohler Program. So why does all this matter? I mean, where does the water hit the wheel on this one? Well, again, I think parents know it. I think families know it. I think the society at large knows it, and certainly the church should know it. A good friend of mine was telling me about the fact that his grandmother is very offended that some of the ladies in her Sunday school class, or at least one of them, comes and at prayer request time ask people to pray for characters in soap operas. She insists that it's important. Now, you know, that is a functional inability to distinguish the real from the unreal. But evidently, that's where this lady lives, and she's so wrapped up in these characters, she wants to pray that everything's end up happily. Everything will end up just swell and all the rest. So let me tell you, here's the bad news, Granny. That ain't going to happen. The soap opera's a soap opera because it isn't going to turn out happy. And it's a story. These are actors and actresses. This isn't real. The inability to distinguish between the true and the false, the real and the unreal, is a real problem in this society. We have so privileged the false that we sometimes don't even seem to recognize what is true. I mentioned that Christians have a particular responsibility in this. Let me say, as a Christian preacher, that we, as preachers of the Word, have a very special responsibility in this regard. We have to make sure that the stories we tell, if we tell them as true, are true. We have to be very careful that we never put ourselves in the first person in someone else's story. We have to be very, very careful that we do not use someone else's material as if it is our own. We have to be very, very careful that when we talk about the truth and bear testimony to the truth and preach the truth, we better always tell the truth. You know, in reality, this whole controversy over James Frye's memoir, A Million Little Pieces, could be taken in a million different directions. And it probably ought to do so, because the issue of truth is just that important. It really is important that our children learn to tell the truth. It really is important that our government tell the truth. It is very important that authors tell the truth when they're writing what they present to be the truth. It's important that preachers tell the truth. It's important in the courtroom that a witness tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. A society that no longer values truth has accepted the poison pill of the lie. And it will no longer be able to distinguish the real from the unreal, the true from the untrue. And before long, that means we will value the lie more than the truth, which is exactly what the Apostle Paul says in Romans chapter 1. He says that one of the clear symptoms of human sinfulness is that we prefer the lie to the truth. We suppress the truth in unrighteousness, Paul says. Well, I think we had a demonstration of that with this controversy over James Frye, and who knows where this goes. One of the latest manifestations of this controversy is people saying maybe publishers, here's a radical thought, ought to check the truthfulness of the books they publish. Wow. Well, that just might change things. Quite frankly, it might mean there are fewer books at your local bookstore. Folks, this is a place for intelligent Christian conversation. We do our best day by day to think like Christians should think and to involve ourselves in a conversation all across America with thinking Christians who want to learn how to think Christianly. I'll meet you tomorrow. We're going to look at the legacy of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I'm Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.